You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.
Does not exist, take an exit. I hear voices insinuating, feeds me words to this song that I'm singing. Sunlight, 7:20 p.m. early September. Standing looking at a photograph you don't remember. You look out of breath at me like I'm faking. As a matter of fact, I don't recall this being taken. You don't actually exist, so I started shaking. Does not exist, take an exit.
You may remember, or you may have heard, of the Antioch twins. They were born in 1950, during a particularly fierce dime store Christian hysteria that saw the Lord appearing in tingly fogs in bakery windows, or found the Mother Mary in a lump sculpture of meat stew. Miss Abigail Antioch, who lived on the street that intersected with mine, was a single woman who happened to be pregnant, but refused to admit to having had relations. As she was a well-tithed member of a willfully naive and thought-conserving congregation, her story was quietly consecrated by her local shepherd, and then later for his protection, and perhaps to slide a little error by the board via the ongoing hysteria. Certain other higher-ups were called upon to confirm that, indeed, Miss Abigail Antioch was a Vestal Virgin, that the child she was carrying was, to the church's satisfaction, immaculately conceived, as was apparently possible, according to some winky-eyed interpretation of Scripture. It was hoped that this final word might quell the tide of interest, and that the local zealots might return to their foggy Christ window discoveries and meet Chunk Mary sculpture visitations. But a great debate arose as to whether an immaculate conception necessitated the rebirth of Christ, or whether the child in her womb might just be a normal citizen, a potential plumber, or sports reporter. It was judged by an informal council of church elders, who were yet diligently tethered to a formal council far away, who had conjoined to consider the highest points of canonical law, that the Lord bringeth in the way he saw fit, and that it would be perfectly acceptable that he might bring certain children into the world who would simply be guardians of his word, not then yet necessarily a second coming of Christ at all. In fact, there was a blush and hush of blasphemy about the suggestion, despite the fact that a second coming was the predominantly looming great hope of the council. Thus, rather the unsmirched baby in Abigail Antioch's sterile but inhabited womb would be a first coming of Albert or Alice, who, it would come to pass, would turn out to be quite nice and excellent, a special citizen, born Samaritan. Miss Antioch lived in her parents' home, surrounded by a tribe of great American elms. I remember how, shortly after her parents' death, and just as the hysteria was building around the immaculate gift in her belly, Abigail had an in-ground pool put in, something excessively strange at the time. Six of the huge elms were dropped, and I called out, "Timber," with each one, as I imagined I might do such calling out in the future as a way of making a living. I also lurked at the local golf course and called out, "Four," if I saw a particularly powerful and egregious golf drive. But what was odd about the installation of the pool was that, although the home was large, the property was not, and the in-ground pool had to be built almost against the foundation of the home, such that it was joked that a door might replace the second-floor window and a diving board be attached, that Abigail and her very good, but not Christ child, could simply come tweetering out of the house whenever it seemed a good time for a swim. At any rate, I was 12 or so at the time of the birthing. We were all deeply and sharply excited, to the point of insomnia. One couldn't help but think in the simultaneous ways of such things that the world was about to end, or begin again. Heaven or hell seemed closer than they'd ever been. Of all things, Miss Antioch had twins, a boy and a girl, whom she named sweetly, awfully, Adam and Eve. For whatever reason, the fact of twins was construed quite negatively. Where one child would have been from God's hands, two seemed likely from the devil's. This opinion was engendered, so it was said, by the obvious fact that God, who apparently had uttered statements on the topic, was not in favor of twins. And why should he be? The churchgoers asked. God wasn't in a rush. He didn't need to heap out all his children from a single womb. He could go elsewhere, anywhere. Why would he risk it? It didn't help that the children, especially the girl, were a little dark in the skin. It was a troubling few months. I was given to understand that my chosen career path of calling out warnings for those who were unable to or who were afraid, like Timber and Four, were non-occupational, and that no one did them. I was shocked, as it seemed like such a dramatic and useful position. Nevertheless, I began probing for a new career and discovered that I quite liked the idea of delivering mail. Delivering mail seemed a very good alternative to calling out warnings. In fact, it was the carrying around of messages that appealed to me, completing the loop, putting plug A into hole B. As far as public opinion on the Antioch situation, elation had turned to distemper. Abigail's church forbade her entrance and held some kind of late-night special council which employed candles and incense and was allowed to be photographed and observed by the laity. This dark meeting culminated in the release of quite bad news. Higher guidance had intervened to assist in the determination that the children were, sadly, of rugged and unfavorable condition. Figuratively, what was pointed out by the newspapers and the church council was something to the effect that while no witch hunt could be ratified, the Antioch family was an incipient brood or coven of witches, from whom we might all pray quick deliverance. I had no real position around Miss Antioch, other than excitement and pleasure, and now imagining that some day soon I would be running up her steps with mail in hand. Her living so close to my own home meant that I could wander by at any time and glance at the shade-drawn gable windows of the huge Gothic Antioch home and wonder what sort of awful or great mysteries might be at work inside, and whether, in my future capacity as mailman, I might be invited to bear witness. I was also deeply fascinated by the pool and longed, at the hottest moments of the day, to slip through the fence and sneak out a quiet swim. Again, this seemed an arrangement that would be very quickly hammered out over a bundle of fresh mail. I will shift perspectives here, as a shifting perspective is what I was subject to at the time. It will give my account a disjointed aspect, but it is honest from my experience. It was probably 7 or 8 months since the birth of Adam and Eve. Abigail Antioch had essentially barricaded herself in. Daily prayer vigils were held in the late afternoons. These were not supposed to be angry events, but one of the vigilantes usually became exercised and would call out a bad name or two, or toss a rock at the home. As things began to heat up, I found myself visiting the home more and more, just to watch from a distance what looked to be a very slow collision of very large things. As the reality on Elm Street deteriorated, I found myself getting sick. My temperature rose, and I was forced to take to bed. I had no other symptoms but enormous fatigue and an incredible fever. No coughing, no sore throat, no runny nose. At any rate, my fever was such that time had started to slow and reality to blur. It was like a wet glass of some kind had slid over the things in my room. It would seem that hours had gone by, but I would find only minutes. And then suddenly, a week had dropped away without my notice. To my parents' dismay, as my own bit of homeopathy, I began wearing my space helmet, secured from the Space Ranger Promotional Department, a radio program that I liked very much. The helmet was simply a glass globe that was probably just a modified goldfish bowl. A cotton batten ran along its open lip to settle comfortably over one's shoulders. To prevent death, a little sausage-like appurtenance emerged from the front and with wonderful, worm-like vigor sprang to life and then perished with every inhalation and exhalation. My parents, of course, thought the helmet might be worsening my condition, and in fact, because of the persistence of my illness, they began to suspect it as the main cause. At any rate, here's where my perspective shifts. I suddenly found myself watching the boy in his bed. He was in his underwear, alone and sleeping without much comfort. There was a hot butter slick of sweat over his body, and I knew he was very ill. I was outside in a tree, watching from the cool branches. The moon was high and full and beaming with white sleep. I was very quiet and capable, and was moving like a snake through the tree branches, watching the boy and wondering when he would wake up. He needed to wake up, I knew. I lightly brushed my hand on the window pane. "Wake up, boy," I whispered. "Timber, 4, time to deliver the mail." He finally wrestled his eyes open and sat up. Suddenly, he wasn't very sleepy at all. He stood, grabbed his space helmet from under the bed, and came out to meet me. I walked along the dark street with him. "Do you smell it?" I asked. His body was wet, streaming wet, so profusely pouring he left a black stringy trail of liquid along the dark road. There were glimmering hints, but as we came around the corner, we saw what I already knew was taking place. The Gothic Antioch mansion was glowing in furious flames. Several filthy fire trucks were kilted over the sidewalk, haplessly spuming their efforts into the sky. And from the gathered crowd, there came a bleary chorus of screaming and shushing and horror. The crowd, too, in a strange orderly fashion, was slowly backing away from the oppressive heat. Drivers scrambled toward the trucks and quickly redacted to safer ground. From the roof of the house, and as though sucked into the sky, rose a constant jet of smoke. The scene was unholy. The crowd of onlookers, with their collective, nauseous noise, a kind of hampered moan, a kind of low scream, a kind of sleepy near-vomit sickness. On their orange-painted faces, a shared grotesque look of blood want, of war-sick urges for death and ruin. Miss Antioch, in a torn and burned cotton nightgown, with black smears all up and down her arms, and blood and gashes here and there, as though she'd fallen through the splintering floor, was being held by 2 policemen. Her hoarse, smoky voice gritted out her children's names in alternation. Adam.
Adam.
Eve.
Adam.
Eve. As we drew closer, I was happy to see that the boy had wisely put on the helmet. He understood now. I patted his wet back. Though muted by the glass, I could clearly hear his voice.
Time to deliver the mail.
Time to deliver the mail, he said, and his sleepy voice faded off. He jogged a few steps away from me, tugged at his white underwear as their soppiness was causing them to drop. A fireman ran toward him, ridiculously slow in a pantomime of running, taking giant moony clown steps, looping forward, pausing, it seemed, between each great silly bound for rest. With his undergarments hiked and his helmet rightly placed, the boy now tilted into a run. Down the black ash path and up the front stairs he went. As he entered the shining white gold of the fire, the underwear simply burned into the air, dissolving in a whiff of black smoke. I hastened in closer to watch. Inside, the boy shut his eyes against the heat, against the blinding vision. Yet still he went leaping up the stairs. The runner rug beneath his feet was a hot soup of lit fiber, his body still furiously disgorged its battling liquid weapon, sweat, which sizzled gray smoke and whistled in the air. Inside his helmet, his dark hair had melted down under the glass and treacled like black wax over his ears and down his neck. At the top of the stairs, the gray fog of evaporating sweat suddenly ceased. He had no more of his wet weapon. As he ran down the hall, his body tinged to green, then yellow, and as he stumbled into the open room at the end of the hall, he was searing red. His feet broke through the fire-weak floor as he moved between the two cribs. As he reached and took a small package from each, the helmet on his head began to shift into a warp. The glass fluted and jiggled oddly with his swiping, turning movements as he began to run from the room. His flesh was soot black, a child under each arm. I watched him racing down the noiseless, soft, white, golden hall, the helmet glass in two small piles melting orange over his shoulders. Drooping now, wilting beneath it all, not breathing, just in the purest final form of his own explosion, summoning forward, involuntary and spasming, burst through the second floor window, a ball of black honey fire spinning into the nothingness of night air, sent straight away down and with an easy Sunday slowness, as though it was a pleasant summer afternoon, a gentle dive into the swimming pool, singeing the water like a molten blanket, soft and spread out and weightless. The two children, who were long since dead, floated free of his arms. He drifted, face down on the water top, cooling, complete, extinguished. His scalded eyes opened like flowers in the pool water, rainbow swollen, nearly boiling, beautiful with life. I swam up to him from the bottom and hovered there, smiling. I looked into his eyes. "This is just this," I said. "You had to deliver the mail," I said. "This is just this." He nodded and reached for me, and I crept upwards into his small arms.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.